My guest is the author of 300 publications concerning various aspects of genius, creativity, and leadership. His most recent book is Creativity and Science. And first of all, I again welcome you to this program. I like to give long introductions, and then I keep quiet because then we look at this more like a classroom on the air where you're going to share ideas with us. And here I want to talk about the whole idea of what do we do to understand the creative nature of the individual? And what would be some of the common symptoms of creativity, both shared by people with psychopathology and healthy people who are just naturally creative? And let's go through the myths that solving underlying psychopathology will also cure a patient of his creativity. There's so many different ways of looking at this whole idea of examining the creativity and genius of an individual. The forum is yours.
First of all, I mean, as you pointed out, there is this common belief that creativity, and particularly creativity at the genius level, is associated with psychopathology and with mental illness. And we have all these examples of great creators who supposedly had major mental illnesses, and so that's supposedly proof. But if you examine these cases more carefully, and in particular if you start actually conducting research using psychometric instruments, personality inventories, things like that, you find out that what you really have is a shared set of ways of thinking, personality traits that mentally ill people have in common with creative individuals. And this overlap is enough that it often seems like they are one and the same thing, but they're not. For example, both are people who tend to be very open to unusual experiences, unusual ideas. They are willing to entertain crazy thoughts. They're willing to be very unconventional, eccentric. They're willing to sort of suspend belief in what everybody else believes. And they're even, this is kind of interesting, there's this one characteristic that cognitive psychologists have investigated. The technical term is latent inhibition. It's the ability to filter out extraneous information. And they find out that both people who have a tendency towards mental illness and people who have a tendency towards creativity share this ability, or I should say inability, to filter out extraneous information. They're like open systems. They allow themselves to be exposed to stimuli that other people would just totally ignore as being irrelevant. And, of course, this can lead to some incoherent thought patterns and disorganization, as you see, like, for example, in a hyperphrenic schizophrenic. But it also can lead to, if you're a creative individual, to, for example, serendipity. You mentioned earlier, you know, fortuitous things, that you are able to notice things that other people don't notice because they think it's irrelevant. I mean, one of the classic examples is Alexander Fleming noticing that his petri dishes with his bacteria cultures were being spoiled by this penicillin mold. And instead of just throwing it out, saying, wait a second, what does that mean? What is this mold secreting that enables it to kill these bacteria? And so that's an example of being open to external experiences. So you have a lot of the same types of cognitive style and personality traits. But there's several things that separate the creative individual from someone who has an outright psychopathology. First of all, the levels are not as high. Yes, they will be aware of extraneous stimuli. Yes, they'll be anti-conforming and all this kind of stuff. But it's not so extreme that it becomes dysfunctional, as it does in the case of someone who has outright psychopathology. And the second thing, and I think this is even more important, there's actually somebody in charge. People who are highly creative, they have high ego strengths. They're very self-sufficient. They're independent, autonomous people. They have these crazy ideas, and then they try to figure out how to exploit them, how to use them. So they don't, in a sense, succumb to the crazy ideas. They don't believe that they have to accept them just because they have them. They'll give them an appraisal, just like you mentioned in your example earlier. You come up with an idea, and it may be wrong. And so, for example, if you compare schizophrenics who are poets with real poets who have high rates of psychopathological symptoms, you find they're fundamentally different because the schizophrenic poets, for example, won't revise. They won't accept criticism. You say, well, you know, this poem doesn't work. This rhyme scheme doesn't work. You don't quite have the meter right here. They'll just ignore it. They have their poem that expresses what they want to say, and damn if you don't accept it. Whereas if you are a real poet, someone will say, well, you know, this doesn't quite work, and you'll think about it. Maybe you'll decide to change it. Maybe you'll keep it the way it is. But there's a there. There's someone in charge who says, well, maybe I need to change this a little bit. Maybe I need to modify it. Maybe this isn't quite right. Maybe there's another way of expressing it. Maybe I need to change that couplet or whatever it happens to be. So that's another important thing, that you have someone who is able to exploit this anti-conformity, this openness, this almost instability in the face of extraneous stimuli. And so that they're not exactly the same. And in fact, when you do have cases, and there obviously are cases of highly creative people who do go mentally ill, I mean, they go over on the other side, they become, their symptoms take over, then the creativity goes down. It doesn't increase, it actually goes down. So that's another example where they're just not equivalent. There's just an overlap between the cognitive and personality characteristics on the two sides.
Okay, I appreciate those insights. Let's go a little further with it. Let's talk about how many people, including in this audience, don't understand what to do with the creativity they have. They may have a very weak ego or maybe a very strong ego. Maybe they're very open to seeing what they can do with their talent. Maybe they have been fearful of being judged and criticized, so they clam up, they close up, they tighten up, they're afraid. And let's be realistic. A lot of people in our society are motivated more by fear than optimism of how good they could be at something. So let's take, if you can, please, take a step by step through how we might be able to bring all this up, be able to look at it, be able to see, you know, what it is. From my own perspective, I've never in my life felt that I fit in anywhere. So I just create my own world as I go along, my own, you know, my own place to live, my own work environment, my own job. And there's a lot of sacrifices. It's very rough. But at the end of the day, if you look back over the last, you know, 30 years of my work and the projects I've done, the movements I've done, the books and articles and everything else, had I joined in, been a part of, been absorbed and standardized and pasteurized, stamped, you know, in some mold, none of that would have happened. So, and I wished I had some mentors. I wished I had people along the way who gave me encouragement or gave me some insights. And I'm not the only one who's chosen a path that's different and didn't have the encouragement or the support to follow it. So I'd like to give as many people as possible the support and the encouragement and the insights, and you certainly have those. And if you spend time now doing that, I think that'd make a great service to our audience.
Well, first of all, there's several different kinds of people we can talk about. I mean, there are people who don't really have any creative ideas. You know, they are very conventional in their thinking, and in fact, we need these people because they're the people that run our society and keep it smoothly running and not collapsing on us, you know, every other minute. And so, you know, there's areas where you don't want creativity. You want people to be able to acquire expertise at a particular job and do the greatest job they possibly can. I don't want a surgeon who's operating on me to say, hey, I think I'll try something new. You know, that maybe some other patient, but not me. And so there are people out there, and we need them, who don't really think in terms of creative problem solving and think in terms of innovation, creating new ideas. Okay, and that's important to recognize that that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing. That's an important thing to have in our society. Then you have groups of people who do have ideas. They have, you know, they have a better mousetrap. They have a cure for cancer. They have, you know, a perpetual motion machine or whatever. But they're unwilling to express them for the reasons that you just said. You know, they feel that they want to fit in. They need social approval. They have a high degree of conformity pressures on them. They feel that people think they're gay or crazy or whatever it happens to be, stigmatized in some way if we let people know that they have these ideas, artistic ideas, musical ideas, scientific ideas, or whatever. And that's a bad thing, because it's a bad thing for the person, because there's a part of them that they're not expressing, and perhaps it's even the most important part of them. They are a hidden poet, a hidden artist, and they're not sharing those ideas with anybody else. They're not getting confirmation. They're not unloading the experiences they have onto other people. And so it's important to get that out. And that means to try to overcome this pressure that we all feel towards, you know, getting along, conforming, obeying the rules, realizing people's expectations, and so forth. Now, this is one thing that is nice, because there's some people who inherit a capacity from the very beginning to always be a little bit non-conforming. For example, creativity is positively correlated with elevated scores on something called psychoticism. And high degrees of psychoticism obviously mean you're going to be psychotic, but moderate degrees mean that you just don't care very much about what other people think about you. It's a consideration, but it's something that you can ignore, because if you have to choose between expressing yourself and coming out with your creative ideas and then accepting that you may displease some people versus just conforming and not letting anybody know about your creativity, you'll pick the former, because ultimately your priorities are towards your own personal self-expression, getting those ideas out, you know, trying to change the world, trying to realize that particular artistic or scientific vision that you might have. So some people, and I should say that psychoticism has, to a certain extent, a genetic component to it. It's something that's inherited. In fact, this is one reason why it's kind of interesting. Creativity tends to run in family lines. There is some degree of inheritance, and they tend to run in family lines that also have some degree of psychopathology in those family lines. So yeah, there's another connection between psychopathology and creativity, is they tend to come from the same families, and part of the reason for that is there's a certain genetic base that kind of gives you a head start, you know, like the psychoticism, and therefore the nonconformity, the willingness to do something even though it's going to defy social conventions and maybe make you look bad according to some conventional idea about what you should be doing. But it doesn't have to be genetic, and it can also be due to experiences that people have. People who come from backgrounds that are very unusual, people who've experienced lots of traumatic experiences or unusual experiences in childhood and adolescence, maybe felt stigmatized in some way. Maybe they had some learning disability or some little handicap or whatever. That allows them to view the world in a different way. It sets them on a different developmental trajectory. They realize they're not like everybody else, so they don't have to be like everybody else. They can go ahead and do their own thing. And so having those kinds of developmental experiences also can free up the person. But then the question is, of course, what happens? Okay, you didn't inherit any tendencies to, you know, not conform, and you didn't have those kinds of experiences, and developmental experiences in childhood or adolescence, you know, what can you do? And that's a very hard thing to address, because how do you get someone whose natural inclination is to go along and not express their creative ideas to overcome that inhibition? And that's a very difficult thing to do. And the best route to that, and the only route that I think really is effective, is for the person to associate with other people who are similar to them in that respect. Other people also have these forms of creativity that they're inhibiting because of social pressures. Well, get in a place where you don't have those social pressures, where there's other people, peers, who have a similar need for expressing their creative ideas. And so this can be a very effective way of overcoming those kinds of things. And you can actually see that sometimes on the Internet. Internet provides a really useful way of doing this. It's astonishing to me how you could have someone who looks very conventional a lot of ways, and then they get in front of a computer, and all of a sudden they're doing all these really creative things. They're posting poems, you know, on the websites and paintings that they're doing and all this kind of stuff. And it enables them to be expressive and get support from like thinkers who are logging onto their websites and participating in them in chat rooms and instant messaging and things like that, to share these experiences without having to deal with these kinds of social pressures.
Okay, I appreciate those insights. Thank you. How often do we see that the artist in our society doesn't just think differently, but they express their emotions differently? And then we come back, if we're in relationships with them, and say, well, what's wrong with you? Not realizing that they have a different affinity for their creative process, which may be completely disassociated with how they treat us, their friends, family, and their partners. So then the cumulative guilt of how you're supposed to behave and act and feel versus what a creative person frequently does feel then creates this schism. And now that the person is on antipsychotic medication, look at Hemingway. Hemingway was a great writer until they put him on antidepressants, and then they gave him electroconvulsive therapy, and then he blew his brains out. And one of the things he said, and I read this down at his home in Key West, that he wrote another famous writer at the time and said that they've taken away my tool, my mind. And what does writer have but his mind? And therefore he felt hopeless. But a lot of people, they don't feel that their mind is necessarily taken away from, but they feel that they're never going to be fully understood because how they go through the creative process is so radically different than how the average person wakes up in the morning, has their meal, and goes out and does their work and come home in a regular routine way. That's not how artists think. That's not how the creative mind thinks. That's not how the genius mind thinks. And so tell us your perspective, if you would, on the emotional components of being different and how we can be so creatively and constructively or destructively.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult issue because a lot of artists, this is particularly true for creative artists, and scientists tend to be a little bit easier on this, at least the normal everyday scientists. Not the revolutionary scientists tend to be more like artists, like an Albert Einstein, for example. But it's no accident that they tend not to do very well in personal relationships. They often go through, you know, several marriages and find it difficult to maintain any relationship for any particular length of time. You have, you know, Pablo Picasso going through all of his various women in his life, and Albert Einstein had his marital problems and problems with his kids as well. And so there's a problem with dealing with interpersonal relationships because, like you said, your creative process doesn't operate on a 9-to-5 basis. So if you get a creative idea that you want to develop, it's got to be developed right then. Albert Einstein was famous for, right in the middle of a conversation, he would often get up and go into a study and just strand company, you know, saying, well, you know, I got to, and he wouldn't even apologize for it. I mean, this is what geniuses do, you know. And artists will often get on a binge of, you know, working on some painting or some novel or whatever it happens to be, and they can't stop. And they can go without sleep, you know, for days. They get into a hypomanic mode where they just can't stop, and they're just full of enthusiasm, and everything else gets dropped. All their family responsibilities, any other responsibilities they might have, are just completely dispensed with because they got this idea that they got to realize, they got to manifest, and get out of their heads. And that puts a big strain on everybody else, and particularly if they have significant others who, you know, are not creative themselves and can't relate. What is this person going through? Why is all of a sudden this person in this hyper mode? Why can't he or she stop and give me a hug or pay attention to me or carry on a conversation or answer my question about what they want for dinner or whatever it happens to be? And it's a difficult thing to do, and it requires a tremendous amount of patience on the part of the significant other. And that's why sometimes what works best is when the significant other is someone who also is very creative. I mean, a good example is like the Curries, you know. You have Marie Curie and Pierre Curie, and they're both scientists, and they both love what they do, and they're both willing to spend hours and hours in the laboratory. They even raise their kids in their laboratory. And one of them, Irene, actually grew up and got a Nobel Prize for herself, just like her mom and dad. So you know, if you have two artists or two scientists who are similar in terms of their thinking patterns and can tolerate each other's idiosyncrasies that way, then it works really well. But it's, you know, that's a hard thing to do, and sometimes you have competition problems and all sorts of things that may arise. But it's a difficult issue, and this is why, as I said before, people who are highly creative, particularly in the arts, do not have stable relationships. They tend to be very unstable unless they're very, very lucky, and that's becoming, you know, even more difficult.
I was recently interviewing and speaking with an artist who was going through a very challenging time in their life. And what was causing the challenge is the nature of the relationship. The other person had an idea of what their world should be, and this person had an idea of what their world should be, and they both started making compromises. And neither one really felt all that comfortable when they were honest about, do we really want to make all these compromises? Is it worth it? And at the end of it, they both ended up getting sick. They literally worried themselves sick. And we know now that through psychoneuroimmunology that what we think we frequently biologically, biochemically, we can become because of the stress hormones or the positive hormones. In any case, it wasn't that they were not compatible in some areas, but their beliefs were so non-compatible. And for one to believe in what the other one did, they literally had to surrender their entire beliefs. It was a major quantum leap. The question is, how often do we take the time to discover the deeper meaning of a person's life and what that meaning means to us? What part of that life can we associate with at all or where? And are we capable of associating with one part of a person's life without having to take the whole life or try to change the person to meet our needs? And how often in these relationships does the whole event of the relationship become one of adaptation and rather instead of the transformation? Because artists, creative geniuses, they love transformative processes. They love to take take solutions where they haven't been before, where the average person does not. They're overwhelmingly intimidated by such a process because they don't know what's next. They can't control it. They like to see everything, touch it. They like to see the boundaries. A lot of creative people don't have the boundaries, either interpersonal boundaries or emotional boundaries, or thank goodness, creative boundaries. That's what gives them that unique edge. And one day we wake up and we go to a movie and we think, wow, that movie was great. Why hadn't anyone else thought of doing that movie? Well, someone did, but they had to think out of the boundary in order to do it. So talk on this, would you, a bit, please?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think it is true in a relationship, there has to be some kind of compatibility, and that often involves some degree of compromise, unless you manage to get your soulmate, and you both consider each other soulmates, and so you're both highly compatible by nature. There's going to be some kind of adjustments going to be have to make. Someone's going to have to yield on this. The other's going to have to yield on that, and so forth. But an aspect of that, and you actually suggested this, that makes it difficult for this to happen for highly creative people is these are people who are changing. They're not stable. They're not one person. Particularly in the case of artists, where a lot of their creativity is an expression of themselves and who they are, and really a discovery process. They're trying to discover who they are and where they're going, and they're evolving over time. And who they are now may not necessarily be who they were a few years ago and who they will be a few years from now. And that means that their partner's going to be taken for quite a ride. It's not just, oh, I have to adjust to this, and then we'll have a good relationship. You make that adjustment, you think you make the necessary compromises, and then you find out that this person has changed on you. They've decided they got something else they want to do. They want to live in a different place that's going to stimulate their creativity more. They don't want to have this job anymore. They want to have some other job, or they don't want to have a job at all, or whatever it happens to be. But they're in transformation. They're constantly in flux, and therefore you can't make the concessions on a permanent basis. It's a constantly evolving process, and it's almost like riding a wild horse, going for a bronco ride. You just got to hang on, And, of course, a lot of people say, this is not fun. I don't want to hang on anymore. I'm going to jump off this horse and find a horse that knows how to trot or even stay in one place. And so that makes it very difficult. And then there's another reason why it's very unlikely or relatively unlikely for highly creative people to have stable long-term relationships. They either have to be with saints who can put up with anything or artists who are evolving in the same way. But even then, they go in and out. When you have Diego Rivera, for example, and Frida Kahlo, I mean, their relationship had tremendous ups and downs. They were both artists who were constantly changing and evolving. They managed to develop sort of a long-term relationship that kind of worked, but it was kind of iffy. And a lot of artists are that way. Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, another example of a couple where there was a very fluid, long-term relationship, but constantly evolving relationship, unstable relationship, but somehow worked.
I'd like to share another option to that I found works, that was very unconventional, and that is that you spend the quality time with someone to bear witness to them, not to judge them, stay neutral, and do not react, but do be present to feel what they're sharing, to try as best you can to understand from your perspective what they're sharing from their perspective. And that's the crucial tie line that connects two energies together. How often do I say one thing and someone else hears something else? All the time. I can't tell you how many times in my own personal life that someone has said something, I said, I never said that. You've taken that out of context. That is not correct. And yet they're certain that's what they heard. Even on this radio program, you'd be amazed after I do a show like this, I'll get 2,000 to 3,000 emails from around the world, and because we're heard over the internet also. And people will think that I'm talking specifically about them because I hit something that resonates with them. I hit a chord of truth with them that may excite them or may anger them, whatever it is, but there is a reaction. And yet, I'm just talking with you. And but people will, it's as if people connect with what they need to connect with. Well, one of our problems, I believe, is that we have had this historical notion, the Judeo-Christian ethic, that we must take the entire person. And by accepting the whole person, we're accepting the good and the bad, the best and the worst that they are. I believe that isn't, for the creative person, that is an antiquated, dysfunctional concept. It is meant to fail. And I do not believe in accepting any of the conventional suggestions on relationships because I found that they don't work. And yet they're not willing to admit they don't work, but then look at the high degree of abusive relationships, divorces, and people who don't get divorced but are afraid to get out of relationships, they're not happy. So all they do all day is either the male or female talks to their friends all day about the problems in the relationship. But the really great relationships are quite simply few and far between. Unless, now here's what I'm getting to. By bearing witness to the person and asking them to be completely honest because you're not going to judge them, and that's crucial. So whatever you say to me, you have my word that it is going to be held in my confidence. No one will ever know whatever you're going to share with me, no matter what it is, whether it's something simple and innocuous or something more serious and intimate. So that when a person trusts, they begin to open up and they begin to become vulnerable and they begin to share who they really are. And generally, this takes a period of time even being with someone to where they feel comfortable enough around you that they can drop one facade and manifest the real person. Their fear is that, would you, if you saw how many imperfections I had at the very beginning, you wouldn't be interested in me. One point of fact, everyone has imperfections, and I've counseled some of the most famous people in the world, and if you sat across from me and looked at them, you'd think, well, gee whiz, you're just no different than anyone else, except you have a particular talent or you have a certain popularity. But that's just the luck of the draw. But there's otherwise, people are very, very similar. In any case, then you look for what you really do find exciting within the person, and where you do find that there is not just a compatibility, but there is a natural, authentic connection and a vibration of the energies between two people. And then you agree between the two of you that you take the best and you leave the rest. And that is something that is so alien. But in my relationships, it works. The proof is that I have men and women in my life for 10, 20, 30 years, and we are as close, and there's such a affection and a love and a respect and appreciation, and yet it may be just someone that I'll go to a concert with because that's all that I can share with them. I don't want to hear their politics, or I don't want to hear one of my friends is, he is really into this ultra radical political kick, and I don't care about that. That's his business, it's his right, but I don't want to have anyone sell that to me. I don't want to be oppressed by that. And I say the same thing. What about me? What are my beliefs or values? What are my habits or qualities do you not like that you feel threatened by, intimidated by, or simply do not approve of? And then we'll exclude those. And then what you have left is something of a value. For me, taking that approach is a whole lot better than having some wonderful human beings, also creative human beings, that could have had wonderful friendships throughout the time, but because the whole package didn't work, the whole thing was thrown out instead of looking at what did work and that was wonderful and keeping that and honoring that. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think that's sort of a recipe for what often has to happen in not just for creative people, but people who live in the kind of complex society that we live today, where there's so much diversity, cultural diversity, ethnic diversity, just a lot of variety in terms of interests and values that people may have and how they package them in various different ways. We don't have this kind of cultural homogeneity, this Main Street America thing that everybody subscribes to, so you can all carry on a conversation on any topic or do anything, and you all share the same pleasure in it and the same belief in what you're doing. And so, in a sense, what you have to do is substitute one person who does it all with lots of different people who meet different kinds of needs. And so you develop circles of friendships and acquaintances and companions for this activity or another. And it's that circle of relationships that is providing what in the old days you would be expected to be provided by one single person, your soulmate that you can do anything with, think any thought with, and share any experience with. And that's becoming increasingly unlikely. It's very, very hard to find someone who can meet all your needs and do all the things that you want to do and believe all the things that you want to believe. And you're not necessarily meeting their needs any more than they are. And that also solves the problem we were talking about earlier, is that having somebody who can keep up with the changes and transformations in a creative artist, you know, well, if they have a lot of different people meeting their various needs and lots of different kinds of relationships that they're involved in, and then they undergo a transformation in one area, it doesn't mean they have to replace the whole set. It means they add somebody and maybe they drop somebody, but their patterned relationships are going to also evolve as they themselves evolve over time. And so there will be, hopefully, you know, a constant level of fulfillment, a degree of relationship that will always maintain this interest, this value, this activity, this commitment, or whatever. And if they don't, and when they go into one particular area, then presumably eventually they'll pick up a relationship to cover that area. It's a little bit difficult to do because people have needs, and sometimes somebody wants to see you now when you want to be with someone else, and there may be jealousies, there may be envies that interfere with this working really well, and sometimes that causes stress and strain that destroys certain relationships that you have, of whatever their nature may be.
There's another wrinkle to this I'd like for you to explore as well. 10 years ago on my radio program, a caller called in one night. It was Sunday night, and for 26 years, I did a Sunday evening show on WABC radio for 12 years, and then WEVD for the other years. And this woman called in. She was 35 years old. She says, Gary, I'm so frustrated. She says, so many of the men I go out with and my friends introduce me to, well, there's so many things I don't like about them. There are some things I might like about them, but I end up being frustrated. And by the fact I have no right to control them, but I don't want them controlling me. And after one or two days, suddenly I start seeing that, my God, this is a control freak, and that's not going to work. And yet there are qualities I like, but they're not willing to, you know, take some, and they want it all. So what are some things that you can do? Because there are good people who manifest some not-so-good qualities. We're not looking at perfect people who only manifest perfect qualities. And I said, and I remember saying at the time, I said, well, you should come around to one of my, at that time I called them detox health support groups. And this is where I take a group of people for 6 months and work with them every week. And during that period of time, they are encouraged to bring all the problems they have right up and get them out so we can help them and assist them. And then once a year at that point, we were doing a sleepaway where we'd find a place, a hotel in the Catskills, and we'd have, or down at my ranch in Texas at that time, and we'd have a group of people, and it was all meant to help encourage the best that we can be, yoga, meditation, eating right, juicing, detoxing, various forms of self-empowerment lectures. And but if you were sitting in on one of those lectures, if you were around for that week, you'd think, my God, these are the most dysfunctional human beings, angry, negative, toxic, bitter, jealousy, and arguing, and wow. And I felt like the psychic plumber, right? You know, having to go in there and clean everyone's septic system and still not get consumed by the negative debris and the negative energy. And yet I knew something that the average person didn't know. What if the only perception you got of people were when you were looking at a whole hospital of alcoholics trying to get off alcohol and going through all their withdrawal? What if you were in the same hospital and a whole ward had 300 people of heroin addicts going off heroin cold turkey, and you had to see the delirium tremens, and you had to see the convulsions and the projectile vomiting and the psychosis and paranoia coming up? If you made a judgment about the doctor and the nurse and the orderly and the dietitian, that this is your world? No, this is just me helping people at this moment in this world. If you came home tonight, you wouldn't see any of these people there. If you went to the movie, you wouldn't see them. This is but one fragment. But what happens is people are looking at one part of one element of your life and saying, oh, that's your life. So what I did with this woman is, she says that, you know, when she had been to one of these health support groups, and she says, my God, these people are not people I want to be around. I says, hold on a second. I said, you're around a group of people who are in pain, emotional pain, physical pain, overweight or sick, and they are asked, put it all out on the table, and let's see what we can do to help you help yourself. Don't judge someone who is open and honest in their vulnerability and who's shown the weakest part of their nature. Because I could take you into the boardrooms of the Fortune 500 companies. I could take you into the actor studio. I could take you anywhere in America. I could take you to MIT and get all the, you know, 700 professors together. And if you spend a week with them where they were laying out all their fears and everything, it'd be just the same. People are people. It doesn't matter what their title is, and everything else is covered. People cover up completely their dysfunction as best they can. And so you're not supposed to see that. Well, here you're in a vulnerable environment. So why don't you acknowledge that these people had the courage to do something positive? Don't judge them for their defects. Don't judge them for their weaknesses and limitation. Don't judge them for what you think is their imbalances, but rather honor the fact that these are human beings taking a step trying to help and heal themselves. And isn't that a good thing? And then why don't we do this? And so what I did that night, I said, I'm going to ask everyone who's got some real serious problems in their life, let's find one thing we can all do together once a week. And then I came up with the idea, let's go to movies or Broadway plays. So we did both. Well, we end up having something like 400 people between the two groups. And so we went to, once a week we go to a movie, and the other week we go to Broadway play. But the idea was, we were only going to talk about our feelings about the play and anything, any feelings we had about the play or the movie, fair game to talk about, but nothing else. Well, this went on for over 2 years. And I can't tell you how much fun I had because it was a ball. You got to see some wonderful human beings experiencing and expressing themselves in such constructive and positive ways. And if you just met them on that night, in that environment, you'd think they were fine. You didn't see the problem. You didn't feel the energy or the anger, depression. You saw them enjoying their life with other people who were not going to judge them and going to share a positive moment in time. And from that, people began to open up and realize there are other things you can do. So then I said, all right, how about those of you who'd like to go biking and form a bike group? And so what I'm saying is that if everybody got together and instead of going to the movie or going to the play, everybody decided to talk about me, let's talk about ourselves, let's talk about me, my problem's worse, you have no idea. And then suddenly, you don't see the best in anyone anymore. You see their pathologies. And I think our society has almost made it an obsession of highlighting people's pathologies without showing the positive, wonderful, beautiful nature that exists also within that person. And then condemning them for having any weakness and then further alienating that person from having healthy, quality relationships. And I believe if you take the best that someone is and where they feel comfortable and they feel happy sharing something, that's why I say, leave the rest be and share what you can. Your thoughts, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And that gets back to what you said earlier, why sometimes it works best to have multiple relationships that meet different kinds of needs, because in a sense, everybody can interact where they are at their best, that they can... this is something they can share with this person, this is something they can share with that person, and everybody sees someone in the situation where they're the most enthusiastic, they're the most knowledgeable, and they can really have fun sharing this experience with somebody else. I also think another point you make is important, and that is that we have a society that I think has too high expectations about quirks, mental illnesses, eccentricities, and so forth, that there's a lot of pressure that no matter how human you may be, you can't be so human that you might have some kind of failings. We certainly see this in American politics. If there's any indication that someone has any kind of mental illness, had any kind of mental problems, depression or whatever, then their years as a politician are over. People can't accept that. And I don't know how much of this comes from, you know, Hollywood movies and the hero and all this, but we have this misconception that if you are going to be healthy, you're going to be perfect. That mental health means that you are someone who has no problems, and that's not the case. I mean, it gets back to what I said about creative individuals. Creative individuals have a lot of things going on emotionally and intellectually that look crazy to other people, but they don't see it as crazy. They accept it. They have an ego in charge. It's saying, okay, I had this crazy idea, yeah, and maybe people think it's immoral, it's irrational or whatever, but I had this idea, and I'm going to give it a chance. Maybe I'll reject it too, but I want to reject it because it's wrong or it's ugly and not because everybody else says it's wrong or ugly. Well, and so they have more of this self-acceptance, and yet most people have that difficulty of engaging that self-acceptance, realizing, yeah, I have faults, I have problems, I'm not very good at this.
We all have problems. We're out of time, and that's one of our problems now. I want to thank you very very much for sharing.
Very fun.
You gave us some great ideas and encouragement. We really appreciate it.
Glad to help.
My guest, distinguished professor of psychology at University of California, Davis, Dean Keith Simonton.